And we're going to look at the next hook. The next hook, as we study in the comparison of the biblical model of creation and the evolutionist model, tonight's study is going to be the second hook, is this hook that's swimming in the culture of our society today, sanctioned by our government, and that is this idea that only evolution fits the data. So before we begin, would you join me in a word of prayer? Father in heaven, as we join together to study science, to study history, to study how you made us, Lord, we pray that you would especially be with the people, opening our minds, making our minds sharp, helping us to understand these important topics. And I pray it all in Jesus' name. Amen. So what do I mean by data? When I talk about data, what I'm talking about is you, the animals around you, the life around you, the earth itself, and the things that are on the earth and under the earth. That's the data. You know, when science does science, they're looking at data. And the data for origins is always what is here on this planet. What are we looking at? And there's something interesting about data. And I'm going to share this with you, that there's a big difference between the data, you, and the interpretation of that data, what they say about you. Let me give you an example. There was a scientist, he was a very famous scientist, and he was able to train fleas. This up here is a flea, by the way. And fleas apparently have legs, and they're trainable, and you can actually get them to jump on command. And this scientist was so proud of himself that he could train fleas, you know, in this little environment, and he could give them a verbal command, and those fleas would jump. And so, just to prove to his buddies when they got together that how good he was, he would take one of his trained fleas and he'd put it in the contraption he had and he would give it the cue, the verbal cue, and the flea would jump. And then the scientist would pick it up, I don't know how he did this, he'd pick this flea up and he would pull off one of its legs. And he'd put it back in there, give it the verbal command, and it would still jump. And he would continue this process until he got down to one little leg. And then the scientist would give the command, and you could see the thing just sort of like moving around in a circle. It couldn't actually jump, but it was trying. You could see it was trying. You know, they were using a little, magnifying glass to look at, obviously. And so then he takes this flea, and he pulls off the last leg, puts it down, gives the command. And all his buddies are staring there looking at it, and it didn't jump. And so he stands back and he looks at his buddies. He says, you know, I've been doing this experiment for so long, I've come to the conclusion that when you pull off all the legs of a flea, it can no longer hear. Now, that's one interpretation of the data. The data was that when you pull off all the legs of a flea, it won't jump. That's the data. The interpretation of that data was that it can't jump because it can't hear. Now, someone else might likely come along and say, well, another interpretation of that data is it can't jump because it doesn't have any legs, right? So there's a big difference between data and the interpretation of the data. See, the data is what's real. It's the fossil record. It's the geologic, you know, it's what we find in geology. It's the life that we have on this planet. It's the DNA in our cells. That's the data. But the interpretation of that data is something totally different. While I'm going to stop here for just a moment, there is a car with their lights on, and it's a here. So there's a big difference between the data and the interpretation of the data. Are we all clear with that? All right. Here's one of the problems that we face in our world. Since 1987, when the government put their heavy hand on origins and said the only origin story you're allowed to have in this United States of America is the atheistic view of evolution, Darwinian evolution, and since that very day, what they have basically said was there's only one interpretation of the data. In other words, in our world today, for every single child going to public school and university everywhere, on the media, no matter where you go, whatever magazine you read, there's only one interpretation of the data that's allowed. And that's the atheistic, Darwinian, evolutionist interpretation of origins. Well, I did not think that was very fair. So tonight, what I'd like to do is actually share with you two interpretations. Tonight, we're going to look at the biblical interpretation of the data and the evolutionist interpretation of the data. We're going to show them side by side, and then at the end, I'm going to ask you, which one really makes the most sense? So let's get started. We'll start with the creation model. We'll let them go first tonight. Now, anyone who's ever studied the Bible or ever studied the creation model knows that the basis of the creation model is something called taxonomy. And taxonomy is a science of grouping things into their kinds. Okay? Let me give you an example. Genesis 1:21. So God created the great sea creatures and every living creature that moves with which the waters swim according to their what? Kinds. And every winged bird according to its what? Kinds, right. And God said, let the earth bring forth living creatures according to their kinds, and livestock and creeping things and beasts of the earth according to their kinds. So you'll notice there, taxonomy. In the Bible, creatures were created by God according to kinds. You see birds and fish, and you see insects, and you see birds of the air, different things. Even in Corinthians, 1 Corinthians 15:39, we find Paul writing the same thing. He says, all flesh is not the same flesh. You see, in evolution, all flesh is the same flesh, right? You started with a little goo that morphed into you, right? So all flesh really is the same. But he says, no, all flesh is not the same flesh, but there's one flesh of men and another of beasts and another flesh of birds and another of fish. What is this? This is taxonomy. And this is really the biblical model. The biblical model is taxonomy. So what we have in a creation model is we have a creator, an intelligent designer, one who has the ability to design and put information into DNA and to create systems that could actually read that information, create proteins that create you, that could create all the different kinds of diversity of life after their kinds, birds, fish, insects, animals, things like that. And this creator then creates the first prototypes of these living things. And then, and obviously, he would probably create them according to how many they need. And he then, these types of things, these kinds of things, then over time, over the thousands of years, remain the same kinds of things. Birds stay birds, fish stay fish, people stay people, dogs stay dogs. And the idea here is that in the creation model, you're allowed to, these things can adapt, but they never change. They don't morph into something else. In the creation model, the Bible shows us that things start off at one kind and they go on in that kind for the rest of the time because, and we'll find out why in just a few minutes, but this is the creation model. Interestingly enough, the creation model can do something that the evolution model can never do, and that's explain which came first, the chicken or the egg. Right? Think about that. In the creation model, we know the chickens came first and then the eggs, right? Another thing that the creation model can explain quite well that the evolution model can never explain is all the systems that exist in our world today. Like, for example, plant organisms. There's so many plants that require, and we know this in Garden Valley, there are so many plants that require something to pollinate them. Isn't that right? When you go to the store, you got to buy more than one fruit tree, and you got to hope that there's some bees or something to pollinate it. But in the creation model, we know that God created systems. Evolution model, well, how did that get there? How can that happen by random chance, that you have systems that are so intricately intertwined with one another? Well, I thought to myself, okay, how can we, using the data that exists on this planet, determine whether or not the creation model is really a valid model? And so what I thought was, okay, let me find the oldest record of life on this planet. And I will present the oldest record of life on this planet to you tonight, and then you tell me whether or not the creation model is true or not. So in other words, so what is the oldest record of life on this planet? What is it? There's a hint up here. Fossils. Fossils record the, oh, I don't care what you think how old it is, but fossils record the oldest record of life on this planet. You can't get anything older than the fossils. Okay? There's nothing older. So, What I'd like to do is walk you through where we went to vacation. My wife and my son and I went to vacation in the Black Hills in South Dakota. And there in Rapid City, there's a university called the University of Mines. There, and in that university, they have an incredible fossil collection. And so I'm just going to walk you through the fossils that are found in South Dakota and of course, other places of the world that have in the mines. So, but now, as I do this, here's what I want you to think in your mind. Is this oldest life like the same kind of life that exists today? If it is, the creation model matches the data. If it doesn't, then the creation model doesn't match the data, and maybe we should look for something else. So why don't we try that together? You ready? Go. Oh, by the way, before we start, let's talk about how fossils are formed. Most fossils are formed when plants or animals are quickly buried and out of the reach of scavengers, currents, and they're usually, it happens when cementing materials in water or floods cover them rapidly, and according to this. And you know, the ideal conditions, they say, for forming fossils is flood conditions, and even evolutionists agree with that. So let's start. Here's one of the fossils that I found, and a picture of the actual fossil. Here is a fossil of a perch, and there's a perch. Here's another one. Here is a bat, and there are many bat fossils that are available, and here is a skeleton of a bat. What do you think? Looks pretty close, huh? Here is one of the most amazing ones. They had a nice display of chambered nautiluses. If you don't know what a chambered nautilus is, it's one of God's amazing creatures because it is one of the first submarines. It has these chambers, and it can actually lower itself into very, very deep water and then come up from the very deep water, just like a submarine can. And right here, we see fossils of chambered nautiluses. And, of course, in the picture there, there is a chambered nautilus. They still exist today. They still look the same way. Chambered nautilus. How about the horse? Here's a skeleton of a horse, a fossil of a horse. How about a fish? This is the Sparta family in Italy. It's a specific kind of fish that only exists in a specific part of the world, and there's the fossil of it, and there's the fish. Same one. And this one is a famous fish that we like to eat all the time. Here's another one, another set right here, insects, creeping things. The little spider-looking dude there is identified as a wolf spider. How many of you identify that one there as a bee? It looks like a bee, doesn't it? And this one here over there is a wasp. And that one that's kind of fuzzy looking has been identified as a cockroach. Yeah, I kind of wish those things would have gone away, huh? It gone extinct, but there it is. They got some of the insects that we see today. They're all fossilized just like we have today. Even plants are identical to what we have today. I think it's a sassafras, and there is a fossil of one. Here's another one. This is a maple leaf, and there is a maple leaf, a fossil of a maple leaf. Here's one that's very common. It's a fern, and you can see one of the leaves of the fern. There it is right there. There's a fern leaf sitting right there in stone, fossilized. This one's interesting. We found there. This is a shark vertebrae, a large shark. But it's an actual vertebrae of a real shark, the same kind of shark that we have today. And what made it interesting for them is that it's really impossible almost to imagine that you would have a fossilized shark vertebrae because it's made of a material that would decay rapidly. So whatever flood grabbed this dude, grabbed this shark, it was rapid and it was massive. Here's another example of one that kind of reminds us of the flood in the Bible. It's the hatchet fish. This was a fossil of one that was found actually in Poland. And the hatchet fish is interesting because it is an extremely deep in the ocean fish. But yet it was found in Poland. So that must have been one big flood that moved that thing from the bottom of the ocean all the way over to be caught in some sediment in Poland today. And of course, here are some fossil eggs. These are duck eggs that they found. Here's an alligator fossil, and there's an alligator head, just so you could see. Here's a sea turtle, and there's a fossilized skull of a sea turtle. Here are the fossilized eggs of the sea turtle that they found. This is a hound shark right here. It's exactly like the hound shark you see in the picture. Here is a gar, a fossil of a gar, and right there is a gar. Same one we have today. This one's interesting. It's a glass sponge. You know, they believe that these glass sponges were like prehistoric, you know, but yet there's a fossil of one, and there's one that exists today. And you can imagine the fragileness of that fossil. How could it form a fossil unless it happened very rapidly and it was covered by sediment? And so really, what are we seeing here, friends? What we're seeing is that the fossil record, which is the oldest life that we know of, indicates we have the same kinds of life today as we do in the distant past. What model predicts that? The creation model. The data that we have in our world, friends, actually validates the interpretation that the creation model has, that we were formed after our kinds and we remain the same kind. So let's talk about something for a minute in the creation model. And that's the idea of adaptability. You know, what you see up on this screen are two dogs. One is a Great Dane, I believe, and the other one's a, I don't know what that thing is. But it's small, whatever it is. Do you realize that the way that we were created genetically is in such a way that it allows us to have incredible adaptability? But both of these dogs are the same kind. They're both dogs. They're not, even though they were so adaptable, they are still the same. In fact, geneticist Hans Elgren writes this. He says, all dogs from the smallest Chihuahua to the biggest Great Dane emerge from the same basic set of genes. At the DNA level, two randomly chosen dogs differ by only about as much as two randomly chosen people do. Yet the variation in appearance, size, and behavior of dogs is just mind-boggling. That's because we have the ability to adapt. But adaptability does not mean that you can morph into something else that you're not. And we'll talk about why that is in just a minute. Dr. Warren John says, according to the Westminster Kennel Club, an estimated 400 species of dogs claim the descent from a common canine ancestry. Courtesy of selective gene mixing, collies, poodles look different, but continue as dogs, man's favorite animal companion. Isn't that interesting? How about people? You know, interestingly enough, there's a lot of adaptability in the human kind. And if you read the Bible, you'll find out where that adaptability actually began to happen. If you read Genesis, you'll find that at one time, the people of God, after the flood, Noah's descendants, they all went to this plain, and there they decided they were going to hang out together. Apparently, God wanted them to separate. And they started to build this tower. And God did something that we would call today breeding or selection, okay? Not natural selection, but purposeful selection, just like you breed an animal. And what did he do? He changed the languages of the people. And so what happened? What happens when you do that? It's very simple. They all started talking to one another until they grouped together to people that they could understand one another, right? And as soon as they grouped together into groups that they understood, they separated from one another because they couldn't understand that other group, and they began interbreeding amongst themselves, and according to the part of the world in which they bred, and they interbred, we began to see unique characteristics occur in the human family, such as different skin colors, different noses, types, and the like. This is a perfect example of adaptability. Just like with the dog example, where God himself did selection. He actually did breeding of the human family. So we know adaptability is in this process. But let me ask you a question. Does that mean adaptability mean that we're going to, that you know, a dog is going to morph into a bird someday? Well, you know, the University of Michigan did a study. You know, they really want to try to prove evolution. They did a 20-year study where they took E. coli, which is a bacteria that's very easy to deal with, and they forced upon it up to 40,000 adaptations. But interestingly enough, every single time that the E. coli reproduced, it reproduced another E. coli. It never reproduced anything else. And the reason for that is a science called genetics. Now, in genetics, there are two types. There's classical genetics, which deals with heredity and traits, and then there's molecular genetics, which deals with this amazing strand that's in every cell of your body called DNA. And DNA is an information-carrying device that has the code of life, if you will. And the reason why every single time the E. coli was an E. coli is because of the DNA. Let me explain. Dr. Nancy Darrell is a scientist and a botanist, and she writes, "The DNA double helix is analogous to the paper and ink of my biology textbooks. Anyone who sat down in front of a blank piece of paper in an examination will be aware of the need of something more than paper and ink to pass. We need ideas, we need concepts, we need plans, we need purpose, we need mathematical equations. In other words, we need information. And friends, DNA is the information or instructions for life. DNA is the blueprint, if you will, for life. And there's little machines, RNA and various things that unfurl the DNA. They read little strips of the code, they take it and they reproduce little pieces of protein, and the protein go off and become you, like your hair, your skin, and all the various parts of your body. And it works the same with all the other creatures that God has. He used the same kind of mechanism, but they're different. Every single person, every single creature kind of thing on this planet has DNA, but they're all different. We're all different from one another. We have different DNA. Okay, so if you understand that, let's do just do a little experiment in our minds, a little thought experiment. This is a blueprint of a house, right? It's from the family of houses. This is a blueprint of another house. Now, it's also from the family of houses. They may have different color shutters, different color paint, different door sizes, but they're all houses, right? They're all from the family of houses. Now, you'll notice that the blueprint of this guy is a little different than the blueprint of that guy, just like the blueprint, the DNA in that bird is a little different from the DNA in that bird, obviously, because they're two different, totally different kinds of birds, but they're both in the family of birds. Now, imagine for a moment that this was my house. It looks pretty simple. No roof, just a box. That's my house. But I don't like my house. I want my house to look like that house. A little nicer, you think? What am I going to have to do to make that house look like that house? Well, I'm going to have to call a contract, first an architect. The architect's going to take the blueprint of that house, blueprint, and the architect is going to use his intelligence, and he is going to add information to the blueprint of that house so that it makes it into the blueprint of that house. You know, this house has one story, very simple. This house is much more complex. A more complex roof, a garage, a porch, all kinds of different changes. In order to go from this house to this house, I have to add information to the blueprint. Isn't that right? It has to be that way. You have to add information. Well, friends, if you were to surmise in your mind that you could go from this reptile, cold-blooded animal, to this bird, warm-blooded, with different bone structure, different breathing structure, and everything else, you know to go from this to this, you're going to have to take the blueprint, the DNA, which is the blueprint for the life of that animal, and you're going to have to add information to it to make it look like that. But you know, friends, this is exactly what evolution's bold claim is. Evolution's bold claim is that three random, undirected processes can make one kind of life, usually a simpler kind of life, morph into a more complex kind of life. And here they are, random mutations, natural selection, and time. Why don't we look at those for just a moment and see if it's possible for them to do what they say they can do. Let's start with natural selection. Dr. Carl Whelan writes this: "Natural selection is really a very straightforward, common sense insight. A creationist, the chemist zoologist Edward Blyth, back in the 19th century, wrote about it in 1835-7, before Darwin, who very likely borrowed the idea from Blyth." Okay, so natural selection is a real biological process that was discovered by a creationist named Blyth. All right? He goes on, and this is what it is. An organism may possess some inheritable trait or character in which, in a given environment, gives that organism a greater chance of passing all of its genes to the next generation compared to those of its fellows that don't have this trait. Over succeeding generations, that trait or character has a good chance of becoming more widespread in the population. Now, I know this sounds like a lot of learning here, but let me just show you a picture and you'll understand. Imagine for a moment that we lived on an island, and on the island, there were this brand of tree right back here. And this tree, in its seeds, had the genetic material in it that was capable of producing roots that had three different traits. One was long roots, the other one was short roots, and the other one was medium roots. Now, on this island, so all this genetic material was in this population of trees. It just so happens that it could produce these three traits from that genetic material. Well, as long as the water table was high, everything was fine. But suddenly, for 10 years, there was a drought. And during the drought, the trees with the short roots died, and they didn't reproduce anymore. The trees with the medium roots struggled and eventually died out. And the trees that had the long roots, that trait, they eventually were the ones that the seeds spread and new shoots grew. And sooner or later, the whole island was populated by trees that had that trait, the long roots. You know, this is why they call it survival of the fittest, if you will, because of the fact that this trait enabled that thing to, you know, to get over on the other ones that didn't have it. But I want you to understand something, and I want you to see if you can catch this, okay? Let's go back here for a minute. In our original tree population, the genetic material was available for three different kinds of root systems. But after natural selection, the genetic material was gone, and now you only had one kind. What happened? Thank you! Information was lost. Genetic information was selected away. Just like, okay, you understand that? Genetic information was selected away. And that's how natural selection really works. Now, what that tells me is, if evolution is to be, Darwinian evolution is to be true, you have to add information from the goo so it can get to you, right? You got to start with some kind of genetic material, and then you got to add DNA strands of information. You got to add that information to get to you. But guess what? Natural selection cannot do it. Listen to what Dr. Whelan says. It cannot be stressed enough that what natural selection actually does is get rid of information. It is not capable of creating anything new by definition. It takes genetic material where it is, and it basically selects away some of it by accident, like we just show here. What you're left with is less genetic diversity. Less genetic diversity. You didn't add any information at all. You know, think about it like this. Imagine for a moment that this is the first original wild stock of horses, the original set of DNA of horses. And then you, as a breeder over time, decided that you wanted to select them down like this, what you see up here. You got this great big here workhorse, and you got this tiny little horse. Can you imagine that? How do they do that? Everybody who does exactly what this is selection, but it's not natural. We did it on purpose, okay? You understand? And every single body that does this knows one thing. You can't go from that little horse back to the original set of genetic material. You can't go from that big horse back to that original set of genetic material because it's not there anymore. It's been selected away. Natural or unnatural, it doesn't matter. The bottom line is natural selection cannot add information to your genetic code so that it cannot make you morph from one kind of life to another because it can't add any information to the blueprint to make the new blueprint. You got it? Our bodies are based upon that strand of DNA. That DNA is the blueprint. It's the blueprint of our bodies. And if natural selection cannot add information to make new strands of that information, it cannot cause one kind of life to morph into another kind of life. Simple as that. It cannot do it. Okay. So, doctor, you might be asking, well, then why is it that everybody, all these Darwinists say, natural selection this, natural selection that, natural selection this, natural selection, you hear it all the time, right? Natural selection this, natural selection. You know why they say it? Because they know they're dealing with dumbed down people that have absolutely no idea. They'll look up there, oh, does he have a lab jacket on? Did he say natural selection? Well, that must be, that must be, oh, goodness gracious, we're all evolved. You might be asking, why is it that they kind of garfed onto this thing? Well, there's a couple of doctors that answer that in a book called What is Creation Science? Dr. Morris and Parker, they write this, if natural selection is such a profound idea, and Blythe published it before Darwin, then why isn't Blythe's name a household word? Perhaps he was a creationist. Because he was a creationist. It was not principally the scientific application of natural selection that attracted attention in 1859 when Darwin was doing his stuff. It was the presumed, watch this, philosophic and religious implications. Evolutionists were not content to treat natural selection as simply an observable ecological process. They, the atheists, T.H. Huxley and Herbert Spencer, two big atheists in history, much more than Darwin, insisted on making natural selection the touchstone of a new philosophy, a religion without revelation, as Julian Huxley later called it. For them and for many others, the real significance of Darwinian revolution was religious and philosophic, not scientific. These early evolutionists were basically anti-creationists who wanted to explain design without creation. And so they co-opt this idea of natural selection, and now they make you believe that it can cause one kind of life to morph into another. But scientifically, it can't, because it can't add any information to the genetic code. Essentially, what's happening in our world today, when they tell you that natural selection, for example, gave the whale the spermis, this incredible baleen, you know, in the very front of it. It has, what do we call it in the water? Sonar. Thank you. When they look at the sonar in the whale and they say, oh, isn't that a wonderful design from natural selection? Or they look and they say, well, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Natural selection says if it ain't broke, don't fix it. In other words, they're personifying natural selection as having the ability not only to design the intricacies of sonar in a whale or in a bat, but they're claiming that natural selection can determine whether you are or not going to evolve. Guess what they're doing? They're turning you into nature worshipers. See, natural selection is an ecological process. It's a nature process. So what they're doing essentially is they're saying, would you please bow down to nature? It is so wise. Mother Nature can create anything she wants. Let's worship Mother Nature. Essentially, what they're doing is they're turning you into a pagan. No different than the people who worshiped calf idols that you find in the Bible. Because what you're doing when you believe that natural selection can cause one kind of life to morph into another, that can cause something to be designed, you are essentially becoming a pagan. And that's, of course, what they want. How about random mutations? Let's talk about that for a minute. Can random mutations add information to the genetic code to make one kind of life turn into another kind of life? Let's find out. First, let's talk about that. Dr. Nancy Durrell, again, she writes this, genetic mutation never causes an increase in information, and in most cases, information is lost. Did you hear that? This is a modern scientist. Genetic mutation never causes an increase in information. Simple as that. That should be the end of the story. You know, when you think about it, it's kind of like this. This is a information storage device. We all know it as a DVD. And on the DVD, you've got these ones and zeros, and there's a reader that reads the ones and zeros, right? And when the reader comes along, it's looking for the information, and it sees the information, it displays that information for you on the screen, and you see the movie playing in front of you, scene by scene. But then all of a sudden, a random scratch occurs. What happened? The information that was there is gone now. And the reader comes along, and it's expecting to see a 1 or a 0, but it doesn't know what it's seeing. What happens to the display? Yeah, you get all these little squares and stuff, and if you get enough of them, it doesn't work. But what they want you to believe is that random mutation of your genetic material, and I'm talking not about, when we talk about random mutations, we're not talking like you can mutate an arm into a flipper, or you wake up one day and you have a gill on your ear. When they talk about mutations, they're talking about mutations at the level of the nucleotide, which means they're talking about at the level of DNA and RNA, that level, okay? And so as these RNA and DNA machines are coming around, they're unfurling the DNA, if there's a mutation there, that's the same thing as having the scratch there. There was information that was supposed to be there, but now it's not there. Believing that you can, that mutations can cause one kind of life to morph into another is basically the same thing as believing that if you get enough scratches on the disc, you can change the scene in the movie or the whole plot. Okay? Dr. Michael Behe writes about mutations. He says a mutation, now Dr. Michael Behe is a microbiologist, a mutation is a change in one of the lines of instructions, usually in DNA. So instead of saying take a 1/4-inch nut, a mutation might say take a 3/8-inch nut. What a mutation cannot do is change all the instructions in one step, say to build a fax machine instead of a radio. And that's why I said that no mutation ever is possible that you could all of a sudden wake up and have a gill. You see, that's like changing a fax machine into a radio. All these mutations happen at the level of the instructions and the nucleotides, RNA and DNA. Dr. Nancy Darrell gives us an example of how this might happen. When a bacterium becomes resistant to streptomycin, a mutation has occurred in the DNA so that streptomycin can no longer lock onto the site of protein manufacture and interfere with the process. The change could occur at a number of places in the gene, but it will always have the same effect. What has actually happened to the bacteria is that there has been a loss of information in the genes. What was there before is now gone. It's lost. And so what we know here is that it's impossible for this. And I want you to think about this for a minute. Let's use our brains for one moment. If natural selection cannot add new information to the genetic code, if random mutations cannot add new information to the genetic code, then what are we talking about? See, in the evolution model that I've got back here, they're talking about a very simple cell, which we know there are no simple cells. The very simplest single cell has got millions of lines of instruction in its DNA. And so if we're talking about going from a simple cell with millions of lines of instruction all the way up to a human that has trillions of lines of instruction, we're talking about needing a lot of genetic material, aren't we? Million to trillion? Well, come on, guys and gals. We're talking about a lot of information. But guess what? Natural selection can't do it. Random mutations can't do it. You know, Dr. Lee Spencer writes in a book called Not by Chance, he says, the failure to observe even one mutation that adds information is more than just a failure to find support for the theory. It's evidence against the theory. And of course, he's right. Because if you can't add information to the genetic code, you cannot make one kind of life morph into another because the DNA is the blueprint. So we know that now. Science has shown us that. But you know, just in case you're one of those people that say, well, what about beneficial mutations, right? You know, some people talk about, you know, evolutionists, because they know they're behind the curve, they'll say, well, what about beneficial mutations? Okay, well, beneficial mutation. Well, I'll give you an example. One of the diseases that African Americans have quite a bit in Africa is a disease called sickle cell disease. You know what that is? It's a mutation that happens in their blood cell that causes a round, normal-looking blood cell to suddenly look like a half moon or a quarter moon. And of course, that's a very debilitating disease. It's not one that's going to give him an advantage in life. It's not one that's going to make him live longer. But it does do one thing. It's got one benefit. It keeps him from catching malaria, because malaria will only work on the round, regular blood cell. So there's a beneficial mutation. But let me ask you a question. Have you read about Haldane's dilemma? This is really interesting. There was a renowned evolutionary geneticist. His name was J.B.S. Haldane. And this is way back in the 50s and 60s. He's an evolutionist. I mean, he's not a creationist. He calculated the rate in which beneficial mutations could occur in animals and humans. And when he calculated the rate, in other words, how fast can these mutations actually happen? Could they happen rapidly or whatever? And what he discovered was the rate that he calculated was so slow that it was called into question the very fact of evolution or evolutionary genetics as an empirical science. Just to give you an example, they took his science and his equations for this particular understanding, and they mapped it to going from an ape to a human. And so currently they say, okay, it's going to take 5 million years to go from an ape to a human, right, using their theory. And so they said, well, let's double it. Let's give it 10 million years. Let's use his equation on animals and humans and to see whether or not, these beneficial mutations, how many of them they could possibly be in 10 million years. So using his equations, they came up to about 1,600 beneficial mutations in 10 million years. Now, you should be dropping your jaw, right? Because there are trillions of... Now, remember, these mutations are not like your arm turns into a flipper. These mutations are at the level of one little nucleotide in a genetic strand. So if you got 1,600, there are three trillion strands of information that make you. And we're talking 1,600 in 10 million years? That's less than 0.001% of what you've got in genetic material. In other words, when they looked at that, they said, oh, this could never happen. This guy right here, Haldane, is one of the most untalked about guys in the science, in the evolutionary world today, because he basically shows that even beneficial mutations, they couldn't happen at a rate fast enough to actually do anything, even though there really is no beneficial mutation. Wasn't the design good enough, don't you think? Yeah. So the bottom line here is that there is no way that natural selection or random mutation can cause one kind of life to morph into another, because they cannot add information. So let's look at the evolution's last and big gun. Are you ready? This is the big gun. I'm not kidding. This is the big gun. Time. Well, think about it. Let me use how they do it to you every day. I'll use it on you. Right before me are real fruit. Thank you for providing it. Let's imagine for a moment we did an experiment. I'm going to stand before you today, and I'm going to tell you that this fruit one day is going to turn into a frog by evolution. Random selection, natural selection, random mutation, and time was going to turn that into a frog. You'd look at me and say, yeah, right. Okay, we're going to leave it in the church for as long as I live. Will it turn into a frog? Yes or no? Tell me. No? Oh, okay. Well, we're going to leave it in the church for 1,000 years. Will it turn into a frog? How many say yes? I just want the hands that say yes. Okay, no one said yes. All right. Well, I'm going to leave it in the church for 1,000,000 years. Will it turn into a frog? 1 billion years? Trillion years? Will it turn into a frog? Using evolution. Natural selection, random mutation, and time. Come on, man. 1 billion years, it's going to happen. Time is the magic elixir of the evolutionary field today. Let me share with you. They know it. Watch. This guy here is George Wald. He's a Nobel Prize in physiology. He got a Nobel Prize for what he said right up here. Time is the hero of the plot. The time with which we have to deal is of the order of 2 billion years. Given so much time, the impossible becomes possible. the possible probable, and the probable virtually certain. One has only to wait. Time performs the miracles. You getting this? If random mutations can't add new genetic information to make one kind of life turn into another, if natural selection cannot add new information, it doesn't matter how many years you add to that, it's still not going to work, right? You know, natural selection, even on dead chemicals like they want you to believe, can you imagine that? Natural selection, which is a genetic process, it's a genetic process that they're saying that happens with chemicals, dead chemicals, they're not alive. I mean, what are they doing to your brains? Dumbing you down. Time can't do it either, friends. You know, as I was studying this and learning about these things and putting it all together, I began to realize that the real science in Darwinian evolution is psychology. The real science in Darwinian evolution is the psychology of figuring out how they can get you to imagine that it happened. Let me explain. I actually found, I caught them in the act. There's a man named Dr. John Ahlstrom, and he's probably retired now, but he was a professor at Yale University, and for many years, he was the expert in the evolution of the bird, or excuse me, the reptile into the bird, I guess, if you want to say that. And evolutionists, for some reason or other, always want to have reptiles turn into birds. I don't know why, but they do. And so what he did was, he wrote these papers where he says, you know, the first reptiles, in order for them to have more advantageous for them to catch bugs, began to grow feathers on their forelegs. This then, of course, made it more survival of the fittest, so they can grab those little bugs and they can survive more than others. So they got this trait. Some of them had this trait where they grew these feathers on their forelegs. Dr. Ahlstrom, because he was the leading guy, all this stuff was in the textbooks. In fact, in the 1970s, they put this in the British Museum. They put a model of this for everybody to look at. This was in the textbooks of how birds became. You know, this is how we got birds. They evolved from these reptiles, and here's how it happened. Well, in the decade of the 1980s, remember yesterday we found out that was a pivotal decade in our country. Because of genetics, you know, the field of genetics and DNA, his idea began to be seen as non-scientific. In other words, this guy's like a circus clown or something. And so he's interviewed in July of 1983 in a science magazine, and he's talking about his bird theory, and he says to the guy, "Yes," says Ahlstrom, "the insect net idea is dead. It did its job." What was its job? What was its job? Its job was to get a generation of young minds to believe in evolution. And all it was imagination. It was a picture. You know, think about this famous icon of evolution, the monkeys to men. I want you to notice something about every single one of these. They all start with real monkeys, just like we have today, and they end with real humans, like we have today. And what's in the middle? Something that's come from the mind and the imagination of an artist. It's all an illusion. Think about it for a moment. If you could believe this, that real monkeys that we have today can turn into people like we are today, why couldn't you believe this if I drew it? Right? If somebody could draw it, why couldn't it happen? Let me walk you down history's lane of how they used your imagination to change the world from believing in a creator God to becoming totally atheistic and evolutionist. And the way they did it was something called missing links. You know, back in the 19th century, as Darwin's theory was being laughed at by the general public, over in England, a couple of people found a piece in a dig. They found a piece of a human skull, maybe, and another piece. They stuck it together, and they claimed that it was a missing link. They drew a picture of it, and the claim was that it was a 500,000-year-old missing link. The media, when they got the picture and the story, immediately ran this. New York Times, Darwin's theory proved true. It was featured in textbooks and encyclopedias. Man, was this whose plan was this? How gullible are we? Well, here's the little fact you didn't know. The people who claimed to find this little piece of the skull and this jaw and make the little, you know, model of the head, they wouldn't allow anybody to look at the data. For 40 years, people asked to see the data. And during that time, Darwinism just blossomed. The beginning of the 20th century was the decade of Darwin. You'll find that. If you stay with me next Friday, you're going to see what happened to our country because of this right here. 40 years later, they finally got to see the data. And they said, wait a minute. That's a human skull bone and an ape jaw. This is a fraud. But it did its job. For two generations, it did its job on America. The next one was in 1922, as America was focused on actually trying to figure out whether we should even teach evolution in our schools at all. Suddenly, a fossil tooth shows up, and it was called the Nebraska Man. They drew this picture, and they used it in the Scopes trial in 1925. To prove that evolution was true. They claimed it was a million-year-old intermediate link. But years later, scientists discovered that it was simply an extinct pig's tooth. But for another generation, it did its job. Then as we move, you know, then we had the Miller experiment in the 1950s. We talked about that last night. And then we had Java Man as we start approaching the end of the 20th century. There was a guy named Du Bois. He was over in some dig somewhere, and he finds a part of a skull, and about a football field away, he finds a femur of a, not a human. It just wasn't a human femur. You wouldn't think there'd be much to this, right? But no. They called it Java Man. In fact, in 1981, there was a Harvard professor, his name was Richard Lowenton, he was probably the biggest atheist at that time, declared that Java Man should be taught as one of the five facts of evolution. But what was left out, and was of course reported after the fact, was that Du Bois failed to report at the time that he found a complete human skull beneath that skull cap. Human. And so today, this man himself dismisses his own find as just a human and part of a human and a giant gibbon. That's all it was. But it did its job for another generation. And then, of course, we had Lucy, the Australopithecines. There were two families. There was a Lakey family and a Johansson family that went to Africa looking for fossils of apes, right? Trying to find missing links. And all these little red dots, they were doing digs and various things. And they were finding actual ape fossils. Australopithecine means southern ape. It just means an ape. But one time they found a fossil that was complete enough that it had partial hip bone. I'll show it to you. It had a partial hip bone. Well, they just said, well, there you go. There's a hip bone. And then they drew this picture that the ape walked upright, just like a human. And they claimed that it was the missing link. But of course, after the fact, people studying those parts came to the conclusion that it was not. This is University of Southern California, Professor Charles Oxnard. He writes, the fossils provide a warning against too readily acceptance of this view. If the Australopithecines walked upright, it was not in the human manner. Be critical. We must encourage our science students to examine evidence more critically. And I might add, that's what the two-model creation-evolution concept's all about. You know, if we were allowed to teach creation science, it would straighten up the evolutionists, Because there would, you see, science works best when you have people falsifying and criticizing and looking at each other's work. But when you have one group that's in power and they can never get out of power because the government stuck their thumb right on it and said, this group's in power and it's going to stay in power, you have all kinds of corruption. Right? Can you say amen? Yeah, we're all living through it. Here's another one. This one is a little bit more recent. Now, let me explain this. This fish you see up here is called a colenth, and the reason it is because it's got a lobe fin, and the lobe fin has little bone structure in it, just like your hand, okay? And it was they claimed that these things were, they found fossils of them, and they claimed that they were extinct. They were like 70 million years old. But in 1938, they actually discovered living colenths. And guess what? They look the same. They're just like the fossil. Now, in 1998, they used this very fish in biology textbooks that your children and college students look at to suggest that fish evolved into amphibians. And these were the legs, these were the little fins that evolved into the legs and they walked out of the water. Isn't that fraud? They claimed it's extinct, they found a real one, and then years later, they say, oh, see this fish? This fish evolved into an amphibian. It just walked right out of the water. But you know, for that decade, or for maybe even today, they're probably teaching it at Roseburg High School right now, it did its job for another generation. This one is probably the most interesting one of all of them. The Archaeoraptor. I love this one. This one you can make a movie out of, I think, and it'd be an interesting one. Here's the plot. There's an auction in Tucson. It's one of the most famous fossil auctions that we have. And there was a guy named Circus, I don't know how you pronounce his name exactly. He had a museum in New Mexico. And he goes to this auction. And while he's at the auction, he's looking at all these different finds. He runs across this one that you got pictured here. And he looks at it, he says, you know, this kind of looks like a reptile with bird wings. This looks like a reptile bird. And so he buys this thing at the auction for $80,000. And after he buys it, he doesn't ask scientists to study it. He takes it to the National Geographic Society, a big evolutionist group, and he says, look what I got. And before the National Geographic Society even had anybody look at the thing or study it, they put on their November 1999 issue, a great big, huge issue. You should probably see if you can find it. New bird-like fossils are the missing link in dinosaur evolution. And they had this big story and all kinds of cool pictures of reptiles turning into birds and little bird nets, you know, with their little feathers and stuff like that. And so this is about the time, right, when all the believing people of faith chuck their Bibles and gravitate to the awesome illusion of evolution. Right? I mean, after all, they put it in the news. They showed it on television. You know, a news reporter showed a picture of it. It has to be true, right? It was in National Geographic. They certainly wouldn't lie. Oh, no. Well, the rest of the story is really kind of interesting. Turns out that in China, there was a head of their paleontology. His name, a man named Su. You see him here in this picture. And he's standing there holding that fossil with the guy who owned the museum. His name's Stephen Zirkus. You see him right there. Turns out, Su said, you know, that fossil came from China. You mind if I look at that thing? Matter of fact, I have to look at it. So he takes it and he looks at it, he studies it, he says, that fossil is a fake. They combined a reptile fossil with the bird fossil. And so it was the Pitau chicken. You know? And listen to what he says. Zhu cautions. He says, you do get a lot of fakes. It's a huge black market. In other words, you know how China provides everything that we need? The Chinese know that the evolutionists need a missing link. And so they started providing them. This one up here is another one that they're providing. The Chinese are just providing missing links. They'll provide them. You will buy them. The point here is that these are all designed to attack psychology. There's no science here. This is all imagination. In fact, after this happened, the Museum of Natural History in Washington, D.C. said, they want to see feathers, so they see feathers. This is simply an exercise in wishful thinking. You know, and it never ends. I got this off of the internet just recently. Wall Street Journal article, See Jane Evolve. The whole idea behind this is that the evolutionist world is so upset because what they've discovered, psychologists have discovered, is that young children, when they see the world, naturally believe that it was designed. They just look at it and say, yeah, this had to be designed. I see this toy, I see it's been built by somebody, I see this tree, I see these leaves, I see this intricacy, it must have been designed. So they're so upset about that, they realize, you know, we're never going to beat this creation stuff unless we nip it in the bud. And so these psychiatrists or psychologists were probably paid by government, they probably got a government grant. And what they've done is they said, this is what we can do. We can come to children as young as kindergarten age and read them children's storybooks where we show one creature evolving into another and claim that natural selection did it. And after they did that, they did a test study. And after they did that, they noticed that further down the road, they went back to the same children and asked if this was designed. They said, no, it was evolved. So they're starting the imagination train very early today. This is why I do these seminars, because I don't want people to be confused about reality. But you know what? All of these things that they did their job. They brought us the world that we have today. You'll find that out next Friday and Saturday. You know, when I was younger, I used to love magic tricks. Don't you? The professionals that do magic tricks, they don't call them tricks. They call them illusions because they make you believe that something's real when it's not. And you know, evolution is just filled with illusions that create data where there is no data. You know, one of the reasons why there's no bait on the hook is because there's no data for evolution. I'll give you an example. One of the great icons of evolution is this tree of life they show the children. Have you ever noticed that if you run to ground, everything on there is what we have today, the same kinds of life that we have today, or maybe something that's extinct that's in the fossil record. But where these branches are in the tree, there's no data. Where's the data? You know, the question you should be asking yourself is this. What should we find in the fossil record, the basically the only place where we can find the oldest life on the earth? What should we find there if evolution is actually true? Tweens, right? Something between this and between that. Something between a fish crawling out of the sea and a cow. You know, something between an ape and a human. You should be able to find all kinds of things in between. Isn't that right? Well, that's right. You should find those. Interestingly enough, geneticists have been looking at that. There's a man named James S. Allen. He's a biologist in the field of population and quantitative genetics. He looked at his studies into the number of intermediate body types. Now, we're not talking about mutations to a nucleotide, like one of the little lines of code in your DNA. We're talking about entire body types, okay? You got an ape here, something not quite an ape, something not quite an ape, something not quite an ape, a whole body, right? He says, looked at the number of body types expected to go between an ape and a man. And they determined it'd have to be 150 billion. Body types. That means actual body types themselves. Now, anybody who has any sense knows you can't just have one. You got to have populations of these things, right? So if you figure that you only have 1,000 of each one of them, we're talking about 150 trillion different body types, 25,000 times more than the population of the earth today of humans, right? And so now you can't just stop with humans, right? You got to do it with every single animal, with every single plant, with every single insect, with every single everything on this planet. How many individual body types would you expect? Well, the answer is going to be zillions and zillions and zillions and zillions. So when evolutionists show you this little simple tree of life, kind of nice, cutesy thing, the reality is the evolution model is tremendous. We must be able to find zillions of these things. You know, there should be so many of these intermediates in the fossil record that we should be tripping over them as we walk down the road. We should have them as decorative rocks in our houses. There just have to be that many of them. Isn't that right? But guess what? Somebody else knew that was true as well. His name was Charles Darwin. You know, in his letter, it's called Life and Letters of Charles Darwin, he writes this. He says, "If my theory be true, numberless intermediate varieties linking closely together all the species of the same group must have surely existed." Then he said, "Why is not every geological formation and every stratum full of such intermediate links? Geology assuredly does not reveal any finely graduated organic chain. And this is the most obvious and serious objection that can be urged against the theory. Where are the links?" You know, years later, decades later, we come to 1979. Dr. David Ropp, curator of the famous Field Museum of Natural History. This is a place where the fossils are. You want to find out about them. He writes this. He says, "Well, we're now about 120 years after Darwin, and knowledge of the fossil record has been greatly expanded. Ironically, we have fewer examples of evolutionary transition than we had in Darwin's time," like they had any then. "By this I mean that some of the classical cases of Darwinian change in the fossil record, such as the evolution of the horse in North America, had to be discarded or modified as a result of more detailed information. We do see change, all right. It's simply variation within type, the kind of change creationists expected all along." You notice that was back in 1979. This guy could not say that today, by the way. He would be fired if he said that today. Dr. David Kitts, University of Oklahoma, 1972, wrote this: "Despite the bright promise that paleontology provides a mean of seeing evolution, it has presented some nasty difficulties for evolutionists, the most notorious of which is the presence of gaps in the fossil record. Evolution requires intermediate forms between species. Paleontology does not provide them." It didn't happen, friends. So, you know, as we've been looking at this, remember, the whole idea tonight was we were going to look at the data, and then we were going to look at the creation interpretation of the data, and we were going to look at the evolution interpretation of the data. My question for you is, which one makes the most sense? In your heart today, which one makes the most sense? Yeah. You know, I realize that your minds are full, but I want to share one more thought with you, and that's this. I want to talk about you tonight. You know, in the evolution model, you are nothing. You are a skid mark in evolutionary time. You know, evolutionist George Gaylord wrote that man is the result of a purposeless and natural process which did not have him in mind. You are nothing. But in the creation model, it's quite different. In the creation model, you have a creator. And in fact, you are special in his eyes. The Bible says in Genesis 1:26, "Then God said, 'Let us make man in our image, according to our likeness, and let them rule over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the sky, and over the cattle, and over the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth.'" Can I ask you a question? Do we rule over everything on this planet? Yes. Does that match the creation model? Sure does. There is not one other creature in evolutionary time that rules this planet but us. And the Bible tells us that it was intended to be that way. We rule it. You know, when you look at these cute little monkeys, they are only doing what they have been designed to do. They have been given certain instincts, certain capabilities, but they're only being what they've been designed to be. You could pay an evolutionist university professor a six-figure salary to spend her entire life getting a monkey to learn to press buttons on cue, just like you train a dog. But I'm going to guarantee you something today. You take that same monkey and you put it back in its natural environment and you leave it alone, and it will never teach another. It will go back to being exactly what it is. But you are different. You know, when you think about you, you were created differently. You were given the ability to do things that the Creator himself can do. You know, when man first looked at the birds, I know he wanted to fly. Don't you think so? When you see the birds, you would want to get up there and fly too. I believe that if evolution was true, man's desire to fly, we'd already have an adaptation to make it more advantageous for us to fly over there and get some food off that tree. But you know what? The real world is different. In the real world, men and women put together their heads and used their God-given abilities to choose, to reason, and to create. Because that's what God gave us above all the animals of the earth. The ability to reason, to choose, and to create beyond ourselves. And men and women began to study, and they began to look at balloons. And first we started flying in balloons. And then in the dawn of science, we had a guy named Daniel Bernoulli who started studying fluid flow. And as he was studying fluid flow, he came up with an equation called Bernoulli's equation. And some people that were studying the birds began to realize that if you flew air over a wing, like a bird's wing, you could use Bernoulli's equations, and we discovered lift. And then some people put together some engines, and some really smart guys from Dayton, Ohio, where I was born, the Wright brothers, who've been studying the birds, learned how they turned, learned how they did their maneuvering. They put it together on a little airplane, and December 17th, 1903, those guys were the first to have sustained, controllable, powered flight. And man took to the skies. No longer bound to the earth, in less than 100 years, we went from that to this, going supersonic speeds. We used our creative minds and our ability to do what God has given us to do, like himself, and we've gone to the moon. We set our sights, we went there. We built robots, and we've gone to other worlds. And we, you know, there's no telling if Jesus doesn't come back, what's going to happen? Because of what God has done in this group that we call humanity, special. So tonight, as you leave, I want to share with you how important it is that you understand the data and these models, and choose wisely, because God loves you. Good night. We'll see you tomorrow night. Tomorrow night, what we're going to do is I'm going to answer this question. Why is it that intelligent people choose evolution? Knowing all that we know today, which they do know, why do they choose it anyway? We'll find that out. And secondly, I will teach you how you can see creation every day of your life, scientifically. So we'll see you all tomorrow night, and God bless.